tend to be more of a discussion, is that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming, you know, I have been working in Manganite for several years now, so I have lots of biases. So I'm hoping that, you know, you will stop me and kind of turn this into more of a discussion then. But, okay, so let me start by thanking Leon for this opportunity. It's just to be present in this awesome place, and I can't imagine getting such an audience anywhere else in the world, so thank you. All right, so what I thought I would go over, Manganites actually is a curious field in the sense, I think for a while it was second only to the cuprates field in terms of number of papers that were coming out and the number of people that were engaged in, but slowly, I think mainly initially, people thought that it will have enormous technological potential, just as the cuprates were. But again, because of materials problems, and which I may mention if possible, but I think the technological potential has been very slow for realization. So slowly, at least in the US, I think there's not a lot of experimental work going on right now, so more in Europe. And the theory again also was kind of difficult going just in the cuprates. So I think slowly the number of papers have kind of gone down. So, okay, I'm hoping that I'll get more people interested. Again, it's kind of much pleasanter working in the field when there are lots of other people, brilliant people working in it. So, all right, okay, here goes. I just review some of the exotic phenomenology. There's lots more which I can't possibly cover in a discussion. And then I will discuss the microscopic Hamiltonian. A little bit brief about previous theories, and some focus on the work that I've done, obviously, over the past few years. Discussion. So please stop me anytime if anything is not clear. There's a pointer here, right? Is there a laser pointer here? Or I can use this one. Yeah, that's fine. Oh, that's the pointer. Okay. Okay, so the materials that I'm going to be talking about are this class of materials. The parent compound is something like rare earth MnO3, like it could be lanthanum MnO3, for example, where then R is typically a 3+ rare earth ion. So in that parent material, all the manganese are in the 3+ valent state. Then you dope this rare earth with an alkaline earth, which is a 2+ ion, which like barium, calcium, strontium. And then in this case, if you, for example, go to the extreme end, which is AMnO3, which is calcium MnO3, for example, the manganese will be in the 4+ state. So in between, it's in a mixed valence state or whatever. The electron number on the manganese will be fluctuating. And the basic crystal structure is well known to all of you, which is sort of a cubic perovskite, the classic structure called AbO3. Where, for example, one way to picture it is to picture a cubic mesh, and the B atoms are in the corners of the mesh, and each B atom is surrounded, in this case B will be manganese, each B atom will be surrounded by an octahedron of oxygen, which is shown more clearly in this slide here, and then the A atoms are in the body center positions. Now this is what is kind of a three-dimensional material. There are actually large variety of manganites, which I will not show for the bulk of the talk, which are called like bilayer manganites, for example, where you have two layers of manganese oxide and then separated by other stuff, and then again another two layers. They also like a single layer of manganese oxide. It will be one layer of MnO2 and then separated by two kind of insulating layers of LaO and SRO, and then again another layer. So there are a whole variety of compounds, just as in the cuprates, pretty much. Okay. Now, the chemists often talk about something called the tolerance factor, which characterizes the detailed structure, because the actual structure is not a perfect cubic perovskite, because there will be some distortions depending on the mismatch in the sizes of the ions, the A and the B ions, they often talk about this something called the tolerance factor. Because in the doped manganites, this tolerance factor is varying from region to region because the A ion is varying. It's disordered in some sense. But I won't be discussing this much, but there is some systematics of this material with that tolerance factor, kind of an average tolerance factor. Okay, so here is one classic example of a phase diagram of this material. It's extraordinarily rich, as you can see, incredible number of phases. So here is there's an antiferromagnetic phase, which I will show you again in more detail, and the paramagnetic orbitally ordered phase, and like a para phase with no particular order of any sort. And then as you dope with calcium, you go through some cantered antiferromagnetic regions and a ferromagnetic insulating region and a ferromagnetic metallic region, and again antiferromagnetic, whole slew of antiferromagnetic regions, and depending on the material you get very interesting incommensurate charge order and orbital order in this region. If I have time, I will show you that. And again, antiferromagnetism. And in one of the regions that I'm going to focus on in this talk, because it's something that we understand reasonably well, is in this phase, which is a ferromagnetic metallic phase. And if you heat up that sample there, sorry, before I come to that, so this shows, for example, some of the material trends as you take different combinations of rare earths and alkaline earths. And roughly, these graphs are arranged in the order of decreasing effective bandwidth. Now, where does the bandwidth change? The bandwidth changes because of this tolerance factor I was telling you about. Depending on the radius of the A ion, there's a bending of the manganese-oxygen-manganese bonds. It changes the effective hopping amplitude. You'll see that more clearly when I discuss the microscopic model Hamiltonian. And then, in some sense, this is the most insulating end, if you like, the lowest bandwidth end, and this is the more metallic end. And you can see kind of a reflection of that in the increase in the metallic region here, like the ferromagnetic metallic region is largest here, slightly smaller here, about the similar here. And then here, amazingly enough, there are no metallic phases at all. It's insulating no matter how much you dope it. So that's pretty unusual, actually. So, and one of the interesting aspects, which is also reflected in a large number of other properties of these manganites, is an extreme sensitivity to small changes in external conditions, whether it be temperature or pressure or magnetic field. So that's really like the bottom line. If you say, you know, what's special about manganites, what's exotic about them, is this extreme sensitivity to small changes. Like lots of phases, all these phases are basically seem to be very close in energy. So you just change the external conditions a little bit, you get phase transitions and changes, dramatic changes in properties, etc. And the way experimentalists identify many of these phase transitions, you can see them in resistive transitions, for example. Like this is the LASR system, and you can see here, for small doping, it's an insulator, clearly. And as you keep doping, it is still an insulator, but you begin to get these magnetic transitions. And this is actually the magnetic transition. So in principle, this is actually a ferroinsulator. I mean para insulator, and becomes ferromagnetic here, but it's kind of a, I mean, naively you might think that this is actually going metallic and going back to insulating, but it actually isn't. It's always gapped, and then as I will show you later, and it's actually para insulator to ferro insulator transition. So somewhere down here it becomes a para insulator to ferro metal, and then somewhere here you can say, I mean, this is kind of a positive slope, so this is really a ferrometal, a poor ferrometal, parametal to ferrometal transition. So that's kind of the how many of these phase transitions. So okay, what's unusual? I'm drawing attention to some specific unusual properties, which is that it's actually that for a, actually at x equal to 0, LaMnO3, as I will discuss a little more, is actually a Mott insulator. And now you've doped it. Now, it's not easy to think of doping a Mott insulator and continuing to have an insulator for a very large range of doping. But that's what it is in a large majority of these things. And it's ferromagnetic. Normally you think of ferromagnetism as promoting metallicity, because you know all the electrons, spins are lined up, there's no conflict of spins, so you'd think that the electrons should move around. But so why are these materials insulating? So that's like the first puzzle, if you like. And you remember, in some of the materials, you never go metallic, like the praseodymium metal material I showed you. It's just always insulating, no matter how much you dope it. That's pretty strange. Okay, so then you get a ferroinsulator to ferrometal transition at some critical doping. So why does this transition happen? And then there are thermal transitions. That is, for X less than this X critical, you get a transition from ferroinsulator to para-insulator. And for X greater than X critical, you get a ferrometal to para-insulator transition. And in some cases, for some of the systems, for larger X, you get a ferrometal to parametal. So the puzzles are basically, you know, what parameters are changing in the microscopic Hamiltonian that I will discuss, why you get this wide variety of behavior. Okay, and it's basically not been easier to understand, yeah?
I mean, maybe, should I think it's surprising the phase diagram with all these rich phases and materials all have transitions roughly in the same temperature? Well, it wasn't a log scale, was it? I mean, just a couple hundred.
Yeah, it's that's also, I don't know, that's surprising, because I mean, I believe, yes. I mean, I will say something about it, so. But it's the magnetism that's driving a large number of these things. So the main length scale that's, anyway, I will discuss what parameters are controlling.
But so sensitivity as far as what phase one's in, but having the, I don't know, okay, you'll explain this.
Yeah. Okay, so then the thing, this material actually has been known, I mean, LaMnO3 and this material has been studied since the 50s actually. But what again revived the interest in a dramatic way in recent years is in this discovery in 1995 of what came to be known as colossal magnetoresistance. What that is if you take this lanthanum calcium in for doping of about 0.2, 0.3, where I showed you the ground state is a ferrometal, and you heat it up, it goes insulating, para-insulator. So here is this, if you look at the zero Tesla thing, here is the magnetic transition. And then you can see the resistive transition. This is a pretty good metal with this thing of the order of 50 micro-ohm centimeter here. And there's a sharp transition from a parametal to a ferroinsulator. Ferrometal to a para-insulator. Now, if you turn on a magnetic field on this sample, you can see with 2-4 Tesla field, there's a huge drop in the resistivity here. So that, and if you work out what is the fractional change, I mean, what is the magnetoresistance, and compare it with what you would see in normal metals with this kind of resistivities, it's about 1,000 times larger. And the giant magnetoresistance, which is these multi-layers for which this year's Nobel Prize was given, which are in all the new hard disks, etc., that's already, people have used the word giant magnetoresistance, and this is even larger than that, and that's why it's called colossal magnetoresistance. And this is one reason why people got excited about this, saying, oh, you got this fantastic sensitivity of resistance to magnetic field, so maybe you can use this for disk technology and so on. But it turns out that the large magnetoresistance here is actually for large fields. Whereas for applications, you need two things. One is enormous control of materials, and also relatively large magnetoresistance for small magnetic fields. And this material doesn't have that. That's partly the why that the interests eventually wane, because the applications just aren't there. Okay, so but for theorists and from a physics standpoint view, it's extremely interesting, because you can ask why is there such a large response to magnetic field. So this is one example in some sense of this extreme sensitivity to magnetic perturbations, because if you convert this magnetic field into, say, an energy scale like temperature, you'll find, for example, the change in the magnetic field is enormous compared to if you took a temperature of the same size and ask what is the change in the resistivity. This is huge. So why is that? There's some amplification. And there's another very unusual effect, which has come to be known as the giant isotope effect, which is very amusing and very interesting, because actually you can change the magnetic transition temperature by about 15 to 20 Kelvin by replacing oxygen 16 by oxygen 18. That's pretty strange if you think about it, because normally how do you think of magnetic transition? You think of them as an electronic thing, and you know you shouldn't affect it by changing nuclei. I mean, that's what you would think. But it's already indicating that somehow phonons are playing a very crucial role even in this metal insulated transition. And in a peculiar way of phrasing this isotope effect, remember in this phase diagram I showed you, there were metallic phases and insulating phases which were like very close by. So you could actually, with some materials, you could in fact generate a metal insulated transition by replacing oxygen 16 by oxygen 18. That's pretty peculiar if you think about it. Okay, and there are also very large strain and ion size and pressure effect. Basically, anything you do to the system, I mean, there are very large changes. And connected with this is something that has come to be known as the two-phase coexistence, which is a peculiar coexistence or fluctuation of two types of regions. One, insulating, locally lattice distorted, and the other seems to be metallic and locally undistorted. And the regions can be static or dynamic depending on the experiments that you do and the time scales that you invoke, and ranging in sizes from 100 to 1000 angstrom. So here I show you two examples of this. This is STM images of some thin films of lanthanum calcium manganese oxide. And around just temperatures just close to the TC, the transition temperature. And this is about 0.6 micron by 0.6 micron each frame. So 600 nanometers by 600 nanometers. And what's been changing here is different magnetic fields. And the dark regions, this region is metallic and this region is insulating. And you can see as you change these cycle the temperature and magnetic field around, what the STM tip is seeing is different sizes of metallic regions and insulating regions. They're just redistributing and adjusting themselves. So that's
just a resist.
Pardon?
Turns the field off and then turns it on again and we're
raising. In this one, they didn't do that experiment. I don't know, but I will show you another experiment. For example, where slightly different. So I will come and discuss this. I think it depends on the scale of the thing. Okay. Here, for example, was micron size inhomogeneities, larger scale inhomogeneities, studied using photoemission. So they did what is called spatially sensitive photoemission by having a very small focus laser beam, and you can look at different micron-sized sample portions of the sample and check what is for the density of states at the Fermi level and ask whether it's metallic or insulating. And they found, for example, surprisingly, here the red area is insulating and the green, yellow is like metallic. So they found that there were insulating regions which changed in size as you cycle through temperature. Like for example here in this case it actually becoming metallic and the insulating is disappearing, but when you cool it back it appears in exactly the same place in this case. So there are micron size inhomogeneities here which are actually seem to be stuck, and in fact we have some explanation for that. I will come back and discuss that.
These are surface probes, right?
Pardon?
Both of these are surface probes.
Yeah.
So are there any bulk probes that show this?
Not that I know. It's difficult.
There's a paper last 2 weeks ago in NAS of YOS, which is is electron microscopy. Mm-hmm. And there they show there are also
big similar things, I think.
Similar things, on a smaller scale, though.
I'll show you simulations where you can get something like this in the bulk. So this is actually not a surface feature, but okay. So there's another example here in photoemission, which again is an example of an extreme sensitivity. So here, for example, is some core level spectra of the manganese 3p core level thing, where you kick out an electron from the manganese 3p core and put it out, and then you measure the spectrum. And here is the main peak, and then you change the temperature, and you find that there's a shoulder which is shifted about 2 to 3 electron volts away from the main peak, which is changing in intensity as you change the temperature between 28K and 300K. That's extraordinary if you think about it, because you know you're changing KBT of the order of millivolts, and then here your spectral changes at 2 electron volts away from the main peak. There are shifts being generated by this temperature scale. And what Tanaka and company, who did this experiment, did also is to subtract this main peak from the, like a background from this thing, and then just looked at this. There are sort of error bars, but still, they looked at the intensity under the shoulder, and
Fermi surface, Fermi energy.
Pardon?
I'm not asking you a conceptual question. Where, how deep?
No, this is a Fermi level, I presume. This is the core level photo emission, so it's one of the edge spectra. So.
And it's an electron volt that will peak away from.
No, this is the binding energy from the 3p core level, which is like very large, right?
That's the
firm energy from where?
It's zero.
Yeah.
No, that's what I was
yeah.
This is relative.
This is energy. Yeah. This is relative. Yeah.
Yeah, well, one's way there, but that's the one I mean.
So it's pretty very strange that you can have these kind of spectral changes. And so these changes, for some reason, seem to track the square of the magnetization. And that's pretty strange. I mean, these changes in this extra shoulder that is developing is changing as the thing becomes paramagnetic and the magnetization increases. So, OK. So this is some examples. OK, so I'm. Yeah, I mean, okay, so whatever theory that we made up seems to be able to explain that. So, okay. So, all right, so I'm going to stop about the phenomenology now. I mean, I have not covered, there are incredible number of experiments in this materials on bilayer, trilayer. I was telling you that the activity was for a while was on the scale of, comparable to the scale of cuprate. So there's a huge amount of experimental data, all unexplained. I mean, really, I mean, at a detail level. Kind of lying there, so it's kind of a gold mine for theorists. Okay. All right. So, what are the active degrees of freedom? How do we model this? This part is pretty clear due to, again, pioneering work from so many people, dating back to the old days. Zener, Anderson, Hasegawa, Goodenough, Kanemori, Dijon, and newer people. Actually, I mean, amongst the audience, Jaron has worked on it in collaboration with Comsky. So many, many people have contributed to the understanding of these materials in terms of what are the interactions at work. And that seems kind of non-controversial. Most people will agree that these are the interactions. Okay. So let's go to the calcium end, which is kind of simpler. Where, I mean, if you just think in chemical terms, you would argue that each manganese is in a 4+ state because, you know, just from the formula. And then you look at the active orbitals or the 3D orbitals, and in the cubic crystal field that is present in these materials, the 3D orbitals are split into a group of 3, T2G, and a group of 2, which is EG. And you have 3 electrons because 4+ is a 3D3 state, and because of the strong Hund's coupling and the Coulomb interactions, you line them up in these 3 orbitals forming a core spin 3/2. And I will in fact think of this as a core spin, and for the rest of the talk, and for most purposes, most people will agree that the electronic degrees of freedom associated with these 3 orbitals are not important. You just think of it as frozen into this spin 3/2, and that's it. Okay. But if you go to the other end here, the manganese is in the 3+ state, so I have one more electron to take care of, and that cannot go into these states because it's again very strongly Coulomb repulsion from this. It goes into this one of these 2 EG levels, and you have an orbital degeneracy here. Okay, and then there is also a strong Hund's coupling between that electron and that core spin. And in principle, Because you have one electron in two orbitals, there's this Cramer's degeneracy, which is very unstable with respect to distortions, and you can split these in this way. Okay, but these splittings are small, so this core spin, I'm going to kind of ignore this splitting as far as this core spin concerned. So in between, the thing is you have a fractional number of EG electrons, and even here there's one EG electron for two orbitals, so in band theory you would get a metal, but this is an insulator at this end. And then imagine I have a small, you know, in between I have 1 minus X EG electrons for doping X. So why do you get an insulating phase when you have 1 minus X electron running around in some bands? It's not very easy to make up theories which do that. Okay. So a reminder of the different kinds of orbitals. So let's discuss the interactions then. So at the calcium end, for example, if I had only these core spins, then in principle there is a super exchange interaction between these core spins, which is basically antiferromagnetic. So the calcium end, they basically antiferromagnetic interaction between these two core spins. Then when you go to the lanthanum end and you start putting this extra electron in it, some more interactions come into play, which is one is a Hund's coupling between this extra electron and this core spin. So irrespective of which orbital it's put in, and the size of this interaction is of the order of 2 electron volts. Various estimates give something of that order. And then the next thing is that, as I said before, you put this electron in one of these two orbitals and there's an instability with respect to the distortions of the oxygen octahedron around it, which will split these two levels. And that brings in an electron-phonon coupling of a very special kind, which are called, called the Jahn-Teller effect. And they are just conventionally referred to, the particular phonon modes involved are often referred to as Jahn-Teller phonon modes. And there are two of them which I focus on, which is, one is normally referred to as the Q2 mode, where two of these oxygens move out and the two oxygens move in, but the apical oxygens don't move at all. And then there's another mode called the Q3 mode, that the apical oxygen move out and all the planar oxygen move in, or vice versa. And you can see that they couple differently to the orbitals. And here I've used the quantization of the orbitals such that 3z squared minus r squared and x squared minus y squared are the orbitals I've labeled 1 and 2. And then this particular mode mixes the two, as you can verify. And whereas this mode, they continue to be eigenstates, but they split in the presence of this interaction. And the point is, because of the symmetry, the coupling constant for this interaction and this are identical in the problem. So you can, if you like, think of Q2 and Q3 as components of a pseudo-magnetic field, and put a pseudo-spin between the two orbitals and write this as an interaction which is like tau dot Q. This is the Jahn-Teller interaction. And then, of course, these are these Jahn-Teller modes. They are basically Einstein phonons. So to us, good approximation, simple approximation. You can, for example, think of them as completely Einstein phonons with no dispersion and no coupling. And that's the approximation that I'm going to use. It's not completely kosher because, remember, this is actually made up of oxygen distortions. So there's one oxygen here which belongs to two neighboring sites. So you can't, actually these modes are not completely independent. You can't move this oxygen and create a particular Q2 without having a constraint on what the Q3 is. It is not very hard to take care of that, but at least for the purposes of what I'm going to be discussing primarily is not so important, as you will see. So in the literature, there is a distinction people make between models with non-cooperative Jahn-Teller distortion, which is this model, and model with cooperative Jahn-Teller distortion, which is taking that constraint into account and actually putting the axial oxygen thing so that the Jahn-Teller distortion at one site is correlated with the Jahn-Teller distortion in the other site. Okay. Now this coupling then, and this energy brings in another scale into the problem, which is this Jahn-Teller distortion energy, which is the splitting energy between the two levels, which is g squared by 2k. How did we get this? This is coming by an optimization of this term in the Hamiltonian and this term in the Hamiltonian. Because the point is, if you create a distortion of this oxygen octahedron, you have to pay elastic energy, which is half kq squared. But you can gain an energy if the electron is sitting in an orbital which is the right combination. If you like, think of this as a magnetic field with some direction q, and then you can make a new linear combination of the orbitals which is aligned along the distortion, and then you put the electron in the lower of those pseudo Zeeman levels, and you gain an energy linear in q. So gq, which is linear in minus gq, but you pay a quadratic energy cost, and you can say when is the optimal. And that's that optimal energy, g squared by 2k. Then the distortion will be kind of colluding with the electron orbital occupancy, and then you can gain this energy.
Is the xy symmetry left?
At that stage, it's still left. But in the real material, of course, there's an additional interaction which I've not shown here, which is that all directions of qi are not really equivalent. There's actually a six-fold degeneracy, and that's just saying because of the cubic symmetry, the orbitals that are special are 3x squared minus r squared, 3y squared minus r squared, 3z squared minus r squared, x squared minus y squared, y squared minus z squared, and there are these six orbitals. And you can generate those six orbitals as eigenfunctions of q in very specific directions. And those are special. So there's actually a term, an anisotropy term, in the Hamiltonian, which in principle, which is like cosine of 6 theta, where theta is the angle of the q. And that actually prefers those. There may be some fluctuation with respect to that, but they are preferred orbitals.
So it's a discrete six-fold?
Yeah, so it's more like a clock model or something is what I should be thinking in terms of, not complete rotation invariance.
How big is that anisotropy from
now? Oh, it's pretty big. So you would probably be not badly off by assuming that only discrete model. But there's some fluctuation which you can measure.
I'm not so sure how large the anisotropy actually is.
There are some, I don't have the numbers here, but there's a paper by Millis where he tried to actually put that in and then kind of work it out and compare with data to extract it. It's kind of on the large side, I would say. That's my impression, yeah.
And if one were to extract from your, within this model and estimates of K and M, can you extract the harmonic oscillator radius?
Yeah.
How big is it?
I don't report.
Zero.
The distortion is about, a 20th. Of the lattice spacing is what my rough memory is.
I'm not asking about the size of the actual static distortion, but
yeah.
If I take the harmonic oscillator and I find the width from zero-point motion, the width of the Gaussian ground state wave function in coordinate space.
I don't have the number in my head.
Square root of omega.
Okay, but the omega is pretty small here.
Right.
0.05 eV.
What mass do you need? Is it mass of oxygen?
This mass is some effective mass, mostly oxygen because that's the lightest. Yeah.
And you say the distortion is like 20th of
a... It's what I remember, but... that's what I remember, you remember?
Yeah, well, the distance is like 2 angstrom, and the distortion is maybe 0.05.
Yeah.
Angstroms.
Okay. All right. So then, when you have these EG electrons, they can hop from site to site. And so you have two orbitals, and they have two more orbitals on the neighboring site, and you can hop. Now, the simplest model of this hopping is characterized by just one parameter and a matrix structure depending on which orbital you hop from and which orbital you hop to and in which direction you hop. And that matrix structure is pretty not very hard to understand, because that hopping is actually mediated via the oxygen. There's very little direct overlap between manganese and manganese. So the hopping actually goes via. So what you have to imagine, this is actually in the z direction. So imagine a 3z squared minus r squared orbital on one manganese site, and along the z direction, there's a pz orbital of the neighboring oxygen, and the next dz squared, 3z squared minus r squared orbital. And the way it hops is, imagine this level is empty, the Eg level. So an oxygen orbital, an electron hops from this orbital to here, and then this electron moves from that here, effectively moving an electron from here to here. And so you can see the effective hopping amplitude is basically TPD squared, which is the hopping amplitude from here to here, divided by like charge transfer energy. Okay. Now if I had a x squared minus y squared orbital instead, you can see that in the z direction there would be no hopping, because that guy cannot hop to this PZ orbital, and there's no way it can hop. And in fact, so that's the reason, for example, in the z direction, the hopping is only between 3z squared minus r squared and 3z squared minus r squared. All the other matrix elements are zero. If you look at the other two directions, then you have to mix these two, or change the quantization basis and work similarly, and you get this matrix structure. So there's one parameter, and this interesting matrix of hopping. Okay. Now, of course, remember these are d orbitals and pretty localized. So therefore, when an electron, as it's hopping along, if it encounters another electron that is already there, it will pay an energy cost u. Now, in principle, since there are orbital degeneracies here, you should distinguish between two kinds of u, which is, when it's in the same orbital with different spins, versus, in the literature, normally people refer to u and u prime. I have not bothered to do that. I just put one effective u, because it turns out that actually, because the Hund's coupling is pretty large, if you, for example, take the limit of very large Hund's coupling here, then the spin of this electron is not really a completely free degree of freedom. It's kind of tied to core spin. So what happens is that it's almost impossible for, like, so what happens is, if, like, for example, this guy wants to hop, it has to kind of line up to be the spin, and it has to hop to the other orbital. So basically, there's one effective u. This is not really important to consider the two u's, but okay. So here's kind of a list, again, a recapitulation of all the energies that I've talked about. You can see that several of these scales are extraordinarily large and close to each other. And like the bandwidth is the order of 1.2 eV. It's a three-dimensional material, so like half bandwidth would be 1.2. And that's comparable to the Hund's coupling, comparable to UDD, or UDD is larger than that. And the Jahn-Teller energy is also comparable to that. So electron-phonon coupling is very strong. It's a pretty strongly correlated problem by all accounts. Now, there are other details which I've left out here. In principle, I already mentioned cooperative Jahn-Teller, which you can put in. And in particular, for example, for some effects, the Jahn has worked on, for example, and when you get orbital ordering, you may have to worry about the oxygen levels. And people do, just in the Hubbard, in the cuprates, you have this controversy about multi-band versus single band. In principle here, depending on the kinds of effects you look at, you may need to invoke the actual oxygen orbitals and the hopping between them, and then worry about the actual, because I'm, in some sense, when I write down this effective model, I'm actually having in mind some Mohnier orbital made up of manganese and the oxygen surrounding it, and I'm saying this is good enough for low energy physics. But if you want to worry about the detailed shape of the orbital, where the charge is distributed, etc., then you have to put in all those details. And in particular, for example, some recent work by Jahn, where they were in this whole class of models, for example, you can worry about where is the charge located, and then worry about ferroelectric kind of actually motion of distortion of these things. With those kinds of modes, I have not put into this, because I'm focusing on these doped manganites and these electronic properties. Okay.
So the, what's this, our transfer insulator?
Yeah, it's probably connected to that, yeah. Correct.
But if you want to look at ferroelectricity, for instance, you want to move charges from manganese to oxygen, for instance. I mean, you need the oxygen, otherwise you cannot get any ferroelectric phases.
Yeah, then the orbitals matter. The orbitals
in a big way. Yeah. Yeah. So those are not here in this model at the moment. Okay. Now, LMNO3, amongst these materials, LMNO3 is relatively easy to understand, at least at a scenario level. Even though, you know, you can say at the detail level, there are still lots of data in this, even in this material, which have not been, you know, like explained in a clean way in terms of having a theory where you make calculations and compare and reproduce the data. That's not there. Okay. So the point is, if you go to very high temperature, you find that there's no orbital, no order of any sort. And remember, there's one electron in two orbitals with either spin. So, but it's an insulator. So it's a Mott, it's a classic Mott insulator. Okay. Now, as you cool.
Would you call it Mott because it's interaction driven?
Yeah, it's interaction driven. Yeah, I'm just using it in a very general.
I don't want to say it's classic Mott. I mean this is would be a. No, I see, okay, I'm sorry, so this isn't...
It's one electron in two orbitals,
this
yeah.
This was the picture as well. Yeah.
Well,
what's that?
The picture's a further...
And for the Benedetti calculation, you also get an insulator if you put in the structure.
Yeah, but you have to put in the distortion, etc. But I'm saying, if I'm going to high temperature, and I'm saying there's no orbital order, no spin order, nothing, so then definitely band structure, if you said like paramagnetic para order, then you would get a metal. There's no way to get an insulator. But as you go down in temperature, first you get some lattice distortion, okay, and which is referred to as antiferrodistortive, and it corresponds to an orbital order of this sort, which I've indicated. Like one sublattice of manganese is ordered, say 3x squared minus r squared. And the other sublattice of manganese is ordered 3y squared minus r squared. Okay? And then accordingly, you have to go back and then look at that electron phonon Hamiltonian and ask what distortion is consistent with that being the ground state on this side and that being the ground state. And you find, in fact, you can put in the cooperative Yantala distortion and arrange the distortion in such a way that the oxygens move in response to that. And in fact, I've indicated that this oxygen moves in here, this oxygen moves out here, and this oxygen moves in here, and that's like all nicely arranged. And there's a the Q2-Q3 combination that corresponds to this distortion of oxygens. And for that, this 3x squared minus r squared would be the ground state, and this 3y squared minus r squared is the ground state. So if you occupy them, then you will get. But still,
how many slices in the unit cell?
Now it's if you just put in the orbital stuff, I guess it's two.
So there's two with oxygen.
Yeah, two atoms per unit cell. But so then, if you go further, then you get an antiferromagnetic order at an L temperature of order around 440 Kelvin, and that's what is referred to as an A-type antiferromagnet, where a plane is ferromagnetic and one plane is antiferromagnetic with respect to the next. Now you can ask, it's an insulator, I mean this super exchange, why is this so? Why do you get an A-type antiferromagnet? Because it turns out that it's connected with having this extra electron in this orbital order. And actually if you work out in detail, you'll find that the super exchange is actually sensitive to which orbital is occupied in the two, and because that determines the virtual transition that are possible in this material. So in fact, you'll find that this orbital order and this is makes it so that this interaction, the super exchange, what you calculate is ferromagnetic in the plane and antiferromagnetic between planes. And so at least this is kind of, at the scenario level, it's kind of clear what is going on in this material. But there is no detailed theory that I know of where, for example, it's an insulator, but so you can ask question, you know, with this orbital order, when you heat the sample, how does the orbital order melt? What kind of stuff? And how does the magnetic order melt? I mean, what's the detail? And there are distortions connected with that. There's lots of detail, neutron scattering, X-ray measurements of these distortions, how they change with temperature and when these transitions happen. But to my understanding, there's no detailed theory of these.
Do those go together? Sorry, I mean, there's two symmetry breaking.
Yeah. There are two symmetry baking, one at this high temperature and another at...
I think those go at different temperatures, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it requires some clock type model for the orbital degrees of freedom and coupled to this magnetic thing and involving the lattice distortions, cooperative Yontele distortions. So.
Scattering point
group
symmetry of the.
It's not fully. It's not.
That you really have the orbital degeneracy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. Yeah. It's roughly cubic, except for the tolerance factor I was telling you about, because the size mismatch of like there'll be some slight distortion from the cubic. It's not perfect cube, but.
Well identified.
Yeah.
Group, which includes
yeah.
So this is in the temperature range below 740 and above
140? Above 7, above 740.
Okay,
above 740. Yeah. Okay.
The local probes tell you still that the altimeter are stored there. So dynamically it's
So there may be local lattice distortions here and there, but kind of fluctuating on some time scale and then no long range order, certainly.
Do we have time or just
Well, in pure LAMNO3, I assume there would be fluctuating with time, right? If you really had no disorder in the system, right?
Yes.
But it's a phonon fluctuation, yeah.
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 That's a little bit off because of this tilted in there.
Okay, so just I won't spend a lot of time on earlier theories because I obviously have vested interest in talking about my theory. So all right, but just to give you a feeling, to put what we have done in perspective, the earliest theories of this material, these kinds of materials, was focused on what is known as double exchange theories. Okay. Which is basically, most of these theories you can understand in terms of this basic Hamiltonian, which I've written down with many terms, and just turn off some of them. So in the double exchange model, basically you turn off electron-phonon interaction, you turn off U, just keep Eg electrons, these core spins, and the Hund coupling between them. And why is it called double exchange? This is, in fact, in the old days, it's connected with this picture that I was showing you about how the electrons move, actually. Because the electron motion from one place to another is via this two-step process. So Zinner called it the double exchange, and that name is stuck. So the idea here is that you have a core spin at each of these sites. And the point is, imagine if the core spins were misaligned, I don't have that in the picture, sorry, let me go, yeah, here. Imagine if the core spin is parallel, then this electron can hop easily from side to side. But if the core spin is, for example, down here, then there's an energy cost, JH, which is pretty large to pay. So because of that, you can see that in order to gain the kinetic energy of the EG electron, you would prefer to align the core spins. So this is an exchange interaction, which is an itinerant exchange of the order of T in energy, which you would generate to make it ferromagnetic. Okay, so that's called double exchange. But you can see that it will be always metallic, right? Once you dope, you have Eg electrons within this model. It will be metallic throughout and ferromagnetic when these Eg electrons move, because the core spins will like to align. So ferromagnetic metallicity, which is seen in many of these materials, was kind of easy to understand within this scenario. And then work by Anderson and Hasegawa did an extreme case of this. They said, let's JH be infinity. And if you want, go to the limit where JH is infinity, then in fact the electron spin of the EG electron spin is slave to the core spin direction. And you can kind of project out the thing and then write an effective model involving just the phase of the hopping. In fact, you can take a limit where the core spin is classical because it's a spin 3/2, and then there's a simple model you can write down where the hopping amplitude depends on the theta and phi misorientation between two things. It looks a bit like a gauge theory of some sort. Okay.
Yeah, what seems to take
Pardon?
Everyone seems to take this class.
Yeah, because spin 3 half, it's pretty large. Yeah.
They agree upon the meeting
day. Yeah, most people will agree that that's okay. And there's some work where you can actually put in the quantum mechanics, but in fact, then Anderson and Hasegawa, they also discuss that actually. But okay. So that's pretty okay. And recently, in 95, Furukawa did the dynamical mean field treatment of this double exchange Hamiltonian, where you put it in infinite dimensions and then ask what happens. And it's an exactly soluble limit model when you take the coarse means to be classical. Okay, and I will come back and discuss that because that's a subset of the dynamical mean field theory that I do. So I'll come back and discuss that. But the issue there is that there are only these two couplings, and you can only get metallic states. You can never get insulating states within that theory. Okay.
What's that with the Lorentzian density of states?
Pardon?
What's that with the Lorentzian density of states?
This work, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, initially I think that's correct. But you can do this with any density of states. But you'll always get metallic states.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I will.
If it's Lorentzian, you get a lot of things that you...
Yeah. I will show you examples of what happens in that. Okay. Then there's a Millis, Muller and Treiman, in fact, pointed out that actually that this is the limitation of this theory. So it's very important to invoke Jahn-Teller coupling. Okay. So they like emphasize the importance of including the Jahn-Teller coupling. But the treatment they did was actually they were also doing the dynamical mean field theory, putting on the Jahn-Teller coupling and the Jahn-Teller modes, but you treat the Jahn-Teller modes classically, then it becomes like annealed static disorder. They also ignore you. Now you can get a polaronic insulating phase if this coupling constant is large enough. But you have some limitation because you get this insulating phase for finite doping only if G is large enough. But once G is large enough, you can only get metal-metal transitions are insulator-insulator transitions. Like when you heat the sample, you can get a magnetic transition, but the system will either stay insulating throughout or it'll stay metallic throughout. If G is too small, you get a ferrometal to parametal transition. If G is too large, you get a ferroinsulator to para-insulator transition. You cannot generate a ferrometal to a para-insulator transition within this theory.
This will make sense. When you say they treat them as a annealed static disorder,
yeah.
Annealed,
because you ignored the dynamics of the Jahn-Teller modes, right? I mean, when I say classically, you just ignored the P squared by 2m.
Slowly compared to what? The electrons moving around?
Yeah, they are, in reality, they do move slowly compared to the electron. But in this particular treatment, basically the P squared by 2m of the phonons were thrown away completely.
I still don't understand why, do you have to worry about interference effects? What's that?
Normally annealed and static, and it's in the opposition.
Well, exactly.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm using the word static in a quantum sense, that it's the quantum dynamics of the phonons have been thrown away, right? But they're still allowed to fluctuate statistically.
Some sort of diffusive effect. I mean, the electrons, if there's some sort of static disorder.
That's true, but that's not been put in. I'm just saying, so the model is basically what I showed you here, ignoring the kinetic energy of the electrons. So then in the Hamiltonian, I just have Q squared by half KQ squared at every site, and then Q coupled to a thing. So if you like, there's a Q, which is the classical degree of freedom, and the spin, which is the classical degree of freedom. There's no U. So think about this model. It has basically EG electrons in a background of classical variables. The distortions.
The point is, you do some kind of statistical average over all possible U's.
All possible Q's.
Q's, yes, sir.
That's why I called it annealed disorder.
So that includes, of course, configurations which are complicated and random which would cause some disorder. But I guess probably since the system is free to choose whichever one it wants, the weight is probably concentrated on uniform ones.
Yeah. No, it's concentrated. It's concentrated on uniform distortions if the coupling constant is too small, and then you get metallic states. But if the coupling constant is too large, then what you get is that it's a self-trapping. That is, you get a large distortion, wherever the electrons are, and the electrons are trapped in that distortion, and you get a self-consistent solution which is completely insulating, that there are as many sites distorted as there are electrons, and every electron is trapped.
So, the theoretical approach, you just take some static distortions, and then you minimize, and then you look at the energy of the electronic band. Minimal static.
Yeah, correct. If you did the thing, that's what you should do. But they did a dynamical mean field treatment in addition.
Did they choose different
stuff? Yes, within the dynamical mean field approximation, they minimize. That is to say,
integrate out the static, the phonons.
No, no, not completely. So what you do is you integrate out all the other sites. So maybe when I come back to the DMFT treatment.
There's an inference effect of including the static. I don't know. It just doesn't.
But if you did a full lattice model, that's what you should do. What you should do is take a random configuration of Qs.
Yeah.
If you, for example, were to do it numerically,
yeah,
the way you should do is take a random configuration of Qs,
yeah,
and then solve the electronic structure in that background Q and background magnetization.
You make some effective theory for those.
Correct. And the free energy of the electron filling of that band will be the energy for minimizing the configuration. You should sample them. Yeah. There's some Monte Carlo simulation of that kind on very small lattice by Dagotto and company, which in fact is the next. Yeah.
This sounds to me like an extreme adiabatic.
Yeah, it is.
Is the energetics really such that I can use this extreme?
No. In fact, I'm telling you, the answers don't agree with the data, because you cannot get the ferrometal to insulate a transition. So in fact, we've gone beyond that. That's why I'm coming to that. Yeah, it's extreme adiabatic. Right. Okay. So in fact, there's some work by Dagotto, Murillo, and co-workers where you do Monte Carlo simulations and exact diagonalization studies of small systems. And they, in fact, with disorder, and they see lots of instances of this phase separation on this, even in the small scales that they simulated, of metallic kind of regions and insulating regions. And in fact, they attributed these properties mostly to these. And the scenario here is then you have these percolating or interspersed networks of metallic and insulating regions, which are magnetically ordered in different ways. Okay, and then you can imagine that if I turn on so there's some resistivity due to tunneling between one metallic region and another here. And then if I turn on a magnetic field, because of the Anderson-Hasegawa or the double exchange interaction, the tunneling matrix element is very sensitive to the direction of these core spins in these regions. So if you turn on a magnetic field and align the spins, you would enhance tunneling magnetoresistance and tunneling resistance, and therefore tunneling amplitude, and therefore reduce the resistivity. And that is a kind of scenario for the colossal magnetoresistance. But there it's pretty difficult to make any quantitative calculations of that, because you don't know what is the, modeled this as a random resistor network, how do the resistivities depend on temperature, things that you control? It's pretty hard to make a model of it where you can do calculations. There's a lot of other work which I'm not going to, in which Jerome has been involved in, where specific effects connected with orbital ordering effects, which is not so important at the region where I'm going to be focusing on, but if you are at special values of doping, if I have time, I'll at least show you experimental data connected with that. So there are interesting orbital ordering effects which come back. Okay. So what we've done, which is slightly different from this, is go back to the model and put in all the interactions, but simplify it in a slightly different way. And that simplification says that two types of EG electronic states arise in these manganites. One is a set of localized polarons, which are kind of trapped at the Antler distorted sites, and they don't hop to a first approximation. And then another, which is a set of band electrons, which hop around on undistorted sites. And so we make a new model involving these two types of electrons. And these two types of electrons are dynamically generated from the electrons that are in the system, kind of in a self-consistent way. And that generation arises because of attempts to optimize the energy, basically, because of Yontella coupling, strong Kunz school, etc. So I will just argue why this is the case. This is a hypothesis. You know, it's not that we are able to show that this must happen. Okay, so there's a big challenge in some sense too. So what I'm going to show is that if you make this hypothesis, make up a model using this hypothesis, you seem to be able to understand lots of the properties of manganites. But there's still a step which is coming from the microscopic model. Can one prove that such a thing must happen? Okay.
Wait, the localized polarons are not fermions anymore, are
they? They are fermions.
Is the number separately conserved?
No, the number is conserved only of the two together. I allow mixing in the simpler model. We allow mixing of the two at the level of number conservation, that's total, but only statistically. There is no coherent hopping hybridization. Okay. And then what are the interactions between these two types of electrons? One is the Coulomb repulsion. Like if you have a polaron at one side, you cannot have one of these band electrons cannot go to that side because there will be like two electrons on the same side and the Coulomb repulsion, you know that. And then there's a strong Hund's rule coupling of both types of electron with this core spin. And then there's a super exchange core spin. And there's another new interaction which comes about as soon as you invoke a polaron, which I will refer to as virtual double exchange. Okay, so which is a ferromagnetic interaction, which is of the order of T squared by Yontella energy. And it kicks in if one site is a polaron and the neighboring site is empty. And this is in the strong JHU limit. I will just discuss it. Okay, so let me just heuristically discuss what's going on in this modeling. Why do we make this kind of a model? So let's look at, for example, one site, and when there's a polaron, what is the physics of that? Remember, I was saying that there's this pseudo magnetic Hamiltonian, and there's this optimal distortion. If you distort and put the electron in the lower energy, you gain an energy which is linear in Q, and then there's a quadratic energy which is elastic, and you optimize, and there's a minimum when you gain the Yontella energy, which is G squared by 2K. And the minimizing optimized displacement is G by K. But so imagine you have one site which is distorted, and a neighboring site which is not distorted, unoccupied. Now, this is a low energy state of this electron. Now, if the electron wants to move to the site as a polaron, what it has to do is to undo the distortion here and generate this distortion here. So if you ask, what is the quantum amplitude for that? That involves the overlap factor of a distorted phonon wave function at this site with an undistorted wave function, phonon wave function at that site. Okay. And that, in fact, if you work it out, you'll find that it's exponentially small. It's exponential of the Yontella energy divided by the phonon energy. And that's of the order of 1/200th of T. So we are saying this is practically zero. So this is what is the small parameter which we are setting to zero in the beginning, saying that polarons don't hop. They just, once they are localized, they are localized. That's it.
Are you taking into account this cooperative Yontella?
I have not. In this simple picture, I have not taken the cooperative Yontella. But even if you had the cooperative thing, so imagine you have one electron, there will be a distortion at one place, and there will be this distortion kind of annealing out to zero as you go farther away. Okay, but so... So you still have to...
The polarons somehow?
No, there is. But still, what I'm saying is, even then, if you have one electron which is trapped, and the center of that, there's a distortion pattern, even if you invoke cooperative Yontella in the whole lattice. And you have to move the center of that distortion pattern to a next site, and that's a phonon overlap factor, and I'm saying that is small.
Sorry, but then there would be another polaron nearby.
Correct.
Which would interact with it.
Correct.
That's
a static interaction between polarons.
Okay, but that may, the polarons might like forming a lattice or something.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
And so you...
That I will put in as an effective interaction between these polarons.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's the polarons that do internal states.
Yes, in principle, but I'm kind of not invoking that at this level because I'm going to do orbital liquid, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is.
But at half doping, for example, that's important to put that in.
But it critically depends on your assumption that you have a localized boron.
Yeah.
That's not for the metallic systems, ferromagnetic metallic systems.
I will show you
some.
I will show you some justification or experimental evidence. Okay. So then this virtual double exchange, where does that come from? So the idea is, now imagine I have this localized polaron, but leaving the local lattice distortion frozen, this electron can jump to a neighboring site, right? That's an adiabatic process, like, because remember the hopping amplitude is large compared to the phonon frequency. So electron can quickly jump to the neighboring site on a time scale of h cross by t, and then the distortion is frozen. When that happens, that's a virtual excited state, because you now no longer have an electron at this site, but you're paying an elastic energy cost, which is, and in fact, if you work out what is the energy denominator for that, it's 2EJT. And yeah?
It's all in an understand, of course, but it is purely one electron argument.
Yes.
And if there's any many body infract normalizing U of T, then the story can be very different. So my question is this really boring, once I put the many body U's in, this argument that T over the phonon energy is 1/200? Now, in fact, if T could be,
even smaller.
Can be much smaller.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, I'm saying, okay, so it's only a relative issue, which is really, I'm saying, for the polaron to move, it's much harder than for electrons to move on undistorted sites. That's really the point I'm making. Maybe if I go a little farther, it'll become clearer what I'm getting at. Okay, but if I have, imagine I have large UDD, then this hopping will take place. So, you know, if the neighboring site is empty, I could gain an energy which is T squared by 2EJT in second order perturbation theory by this hopping process, right? But if the neighboring site is occupied, the energy denominator goes to UDD plus 2EJT, because I have to pay that energy cost. So in the limit of UDD going to infinity, I don't gain this energy. So I can put that as a constraint, saying that the one side is occupied and the neighboring site has to be empty. Similarly, if I have the core spins are parallel, then I don't pay the Coulomb, the Hund's energy cost in this hopping, and I can gain T squared by 2EJT. But imagine that the next neighboring spin is misaligned, then I have to pay the Hund's energy cost. So if you work out that, again, in the large jth limit, you'll figure out that, in fact, it's an interaction which is ferromagnetic, and SI dot SA, that's the symmetry of it, and then NL into 1 minus NJ. This is the form of this interaction. Okay, now think about what this is. Actually, why is there a projection?
Like, you just said we would have to, the energy ought to involve JH for general space.
Yeah, but I've taken the JH going to infinity limit in writing this.
But I would have thought that rather than just SI, not as J.
No, in the limit when they are classical spins, this is all that comes out then. Or if you go to the Anderson-Hasegawa thing, for example, then the hopping is something that depends on, okay.
Suppose they're anti-parallel, then you should have no process, right?
That's correct. So this will go to, I'm sorry, I've thrown away a constant. It's actually SI dot SJ. By squared plus 1. Yeah?
It's constant as far as spin goes.
Yes, that's correct.
Go, right?
Yeah, it's not correct. So it's actually this into NLI into 1 minus NG.
Thank you.
Yeah? That's the exact form of it. Yeah, so it's still saying something about
being generated from.
Yeah, so I was just focusing on the spin part of it here. Okay, but if I, for example, okay, think about what this is. It's a strange kind of interaction, because energetically it's larger by a factor of 4 or 5 compared to the super exchange interaction, because in super exchange this energy denominator is U, or a charge transfer energy. whereas you know, that's like typically 5 EV, whereas this is of the order of 1 EV. So the factor of 5 larger kicks in only when you dope, because one side has to be occupied and the neighboring side has to be empty. So exactly what you're doing is, as you dope the system, starting from LaMnO3, where every side is occupied by an electron, where some bonds have, you know, ferromagnetic and antiferromagnetic, depending on the local orbital order, you're like, every time you remove one electron, one of these polarons, you turn one bond to be large and ferromagnetic. Okay, that's what you're doing in the system.
Well, I thought this argument was not for the polarons, but for the electrons that are the fast.
No, it's a polaron, but like allowing virtual hopping.
But this is not, but you have two fluids.
Yeah, but I'm saying, I'm just talking about one fluid here. At the moment, I'm just saying, if I have one fluid, and only, and some sites which are empty, then I will generate this.
Why does one need a second fluid?
Because it's there. Because that's what causes metallicity. Okay, so let me go on with this. Okay, why did you get second fluid?
I don't know which fluid.
Okay.
Is your heart?
Yeah, I'm telling you why is the second fluid there. Okay, now come from the other end and say, look at this model and say I have Eg electrons running around in a band, right? How much energy could I gain? And the answer is, if the Eg electrons were running around completely freely, you could gain energy which is 60, which is minus 1.2 eV. So you can ask yourself, the Antler energy gain is only about 0.5 eV. So why should the electron at all distort? And in fact, if I had one electron, naively, and if I had no other interaction, and remember T is large compared to H cross omega naught. So in fact, the electron can zip around on the lattice, and the phonons wouldn't be able to catch up with it. So in fact, the lowest energy states of the electron are mobile electrons with minor Antler distortion, you know, like of the order of 1 over square root of n, because that's the time that the electron will spend on each side. That's amplitude will be of the order of 1 over n. So in fact, I'm saying the low energy states are mobile states. If you were to have a small concentration of electrons, then there was no other energy in the problem. But as you dope this, as you put more and more electrons, because they are Coulomb interactions, right? And then this energy of the last electron you're putting in is coming up now. Somewhere along the line, and the Coulomb interaction is inhibiting the kinetic energy of the electrons. So somewhere along the line, it's no longer energetically favorable for electrons to be mobile. If the kinetic energy is becoming smaller than the Antler energy, then it's favorable for an electron to self-trap and generate a local distortion. So, but I'm saying there is this tension or competition between these two kinds of states. And so that's why you can get these mobile states. If there's a string of undistorted sites which are like accessible to the electron, and then a small number of electrons can run around on them, then they can actually gain kinetic energy. Whereas if there are too many of them, then they'd rather gain Antler energy. So there is a competition. That's why I'm saying there are these two fluids.
I think goes a bit against my intuition, but I'm not sure if that's okay. Because if I have one polaron hopping around, it can easily be tracked somewhere by an impurity. But now if I have many polarons around, I get Fermi pressure, and it will be much harder to trap that one polaron. Or is that not okay? Because of the Fermi C that you...
Yeah. Okay, so you know, like.
It's so heavy.
They don't
pop.
It's
polarized.
Yeah,
right. But the argument somehow is that at low doping, there are no polarons. There are just polarons, and at higher doping, there are also free electrons.
Yeah. So okay. So the way it works here is okay. So let's go to this thing. This is the way I picture this.
I thought low doping, you don't have polarons in your...
No, here, in fact, it works the other way. Low doping means, remember, it's LaMnO3, I have one electron per every site. I'm saying, in fact, in a way, yeah, whether you're doping from calcium side or lanthanum side. So normally, people refer to doping in terms of hole doping with respect to LaMnO3. So in fact, let me start from the other end. So LaMnO3 end, so I'm saying there's one electron at every site. So basically, zero kinetic energy because of large U. So I'm saying then it's actually favorable for each electron to actually take advantage of the local Antler distortion and like also trap itself in some sense and gain the Antler energy. So if you want, think of it, every tied to the polaron. But actually, that's not a very good way of thinking about it, because the point is a static lattice distortion is not really a polaron. So I should really be talking about excitation. So what I'm really saying is the model that I'm going to write down eventually, the low energy excitation of that model, I believe, will be have some correspondence with the low energy excitation that are possible in the system. Okay, yes, that's really the thing. So let me think of, picture this, if you will, as that every electron is a polaron here. Okay, and they're all trapped. In some sense, there's no kinetic energy. Now imagine I start opening up, removing electron from the system, which is hole doping. So if I remove one electron, for example, I create the site. Now it's no longer worthwhile having lattice distortion there. Yeah. So I should remove the lattice distortion. Now if you kept the lattice distortion there and paid half kx squared energy, then in principle this site is equivalent to all the other sites. Then this excitation would be a hole, as in a semiconductor, and is mobile. But if you remove the lattice distortion there to get rid of that elastic energy, then it's a polaron. Because then it cannot move.
So
pardon?
How do I know which is the case? I mean, I can see the...
Yeah, but I'm saying there's a competition between the two. Right? Because here, in one case, you win band energy.
Yeah.
In the other case, you win...
So one of them wins at this single hole.
Yeah.
One or the other wins.
Yeah, but in the system, it's very clear that the polaron thing wins, because these things don't move because you have insulating states. Okay, imagine you put two of them. Okay, so these sites cannot move around. These kind of sites are stuck. So imagine you have two sites, like three sites. So these sites seem to be stuck. But amongst these sites, you can imagine having now, when I have two sites, for example, I can put an electron which is rattling around rapidly between the two, right? And then that would be energy plus T and minus T. Okay, still too small. The minus T is still higher than the Antalya energy, so you will not put an electron in that state. Okay, so in fact, you can see, I mean, once the if I were to put that electron in that state which is rattling, then I could create a small distortion involving both the sites, so that will be like a larger polaron, if you like. So as you open up more and more sites, you create the possibility of, I mean, you know, my extreme picture of small polarons on each site kind of may break down and you may invoke larger polarons, but still I'm not kind of allowing for that complication at the moment. So you can imagine that I have these electrons running around on these, which I'll call these mobile electrons, gaining kinetic energy because these are undistorted sites, but their energy is still above this thing. But imagine if you make a big enough cluster somewhere, right? These cluster of undistorted sites become percolating, and an electron can run around pretty rapidly on those and then gain a fair bit of kinetic energy. So the issue is whether at any stage for some doping you can create those kind of cluster of undistorted sites which are big enough for the electron to gain kinetic and mobile states to come below the Antalya energy. Then I'm saying there'll be a competition between polaronic kinds of states and these mobile states which are running around on the thing. And those are the two fluids I have in mind.
Well, those states can be localized too.
Pardon?
Those states can be localized.
The bottom of that, you are thinking about Anderson localization?
Yeah,
or
like
yeah,
yeah,
that's correct. So initially, in fact, when you create those states, even on the when you form the percolating cluster, the lowest of those states would be Anderson localized.
What the mobility edge?
Yeah, so you want a mobility edge in principle to cross this thing. But the issue is, I'm saying that look, there is a possibility here of two kinds of fluids getting generated which are competing in energy. So let's make a model assuming that they exist.
But then, wouldn't you get the same physics in the whole time
model? Yeah. I believe it. You would. Yeah. It's not connected with... right. It's really connected with the filling constraints, competition between different kinds of states. Yeah. Okay. So, and I'm going to, for the moment, ignore orbital degrees of freedom and kind of, I'm in an orbital liquid regime. that they're really no long range, very short, they're only short range orbital correlations. So we're not worried about what orbital this polaron is. And so then it's a very simple model to write down, because you can say I have polarons at each site, which is either just a number operator. It's either 0 or 1, yeah, with a binding energy antenna. And then these mobile electrons which hop around from site to site with some amplitude T bar, which is a roughly of order T. I've left it open. What is that? It's in principle renormalized, like you were saying, with some thing. And then there's a chemical potential which determines the total number of the two types of electrons I have. That's the only constraint I have. That total number is constrained to be 1 minus X. I can't say how many of them will be polarons and how many of them will be mobile electrons. I let the system decide that. And then on a given site, I can't have both, because then I have to pay energy cost U. Okay. And in fact, you can see that if I were to make U very large, in principle, this model can recreate that cluster, you know, like percolating cluster, and all that kind of physics is hidden here, because I put these electrons down, and this electron cannot go to those sites, and it has to move around only on the other sites. So whatever limitations on its kinetic energy arise from the occupancy of the polarons will be there in this model because of this large U constraint. And then each of these types of electrons have a Hund's coupling with the core spin. Okay, and then I've made a mean field kind of approximation of this complicated interaction. I've sort of factorized this and written it as roughly x into 1 minus x. And you can see that that's something that kind of overwhelms the super exchange antiferromagnetism. So I've put an effective ferromagnetic exchange between core spin and the neighboring core spin, and there's a magnetic field. Now this is a very simple model, actually, because it's a Falikov-Kimball type of model. I don't know, I mean, how many of you are familiar with that model? That's the model, in fact, if you ignore the core spins, just that model is called the Falikov-Kimball model. It was first invoked in the context of heavy fermions and mixed valence and things like that. And it turns out that this model is exactly soluble in dynamical mean field theory. And even when you put the spins, there's still electrons. Basically, the only quantum variables here are these mobile electrons. Everything else is a classical object.
Sorry, it can be solved exactly.
Yeah. In DMFT. Can be solved.
If you do the DMFT approximation for this, then you can solve it.
Yeah. There is an infinite dimensions, it can be solved exactly. Or within the DMFT, in any finite dimensions, it can be solved exactly, this model. And it turns out that this, at some rough level, actually has a lot of the physics of the manganite. So, I've again ignored the orbital degrees of freedom of the mobile electrons as well. We've done some work invoking the orbital stuff also, but I'll. Okay. Now I'm running out of time. Okay, so let me just show you the results of this. I mean, so if anybody's interested, I'm happy to discuss the details of the DMFT of this. And you can see in some limits, for example, you know, if I were to make the antenna energy positive or something, for example, right, and forbid those, I mean, because then all the energy of these, all the electrons will be here in the mobile states, right? And then I ignored the U. That's the double exchange model. Mobile electrons moving, interacting with the core spin with spin S. So in that limit, I will be in this Furukawa limit. Okay. Okay, so let me skip the details of the DMFT. I will. So the basic picture is exactly within the dynamical mean field theory, if something comes out of the sort that I had shown in the scenario. Namely, if I have x equal to 0, that is no doping, because there's so much Coulomb repulsion energy, all the electrons, there's no room for the B electrons to move around, because wherever they go, they encounter an L electron. So all the electrons are in this L state. Okay. And the B electrons only have access to the upper Hubbard band, so to speak, because when every place the B goes, there's already another L electron sitting there, and so all the spectral weight of the B electrons is in the upper Hubbard band. Okay, now you start doping within the dynamical mean field theory. Remember, these L electrons are basically classical variables, it's a statistical occupancy. So now there's a probability that some fraction of the sites are unoccupied. So the B electrons can visit those sites. and therefore there will be a spectral light appearing at zero energy with some effective bandwidth, which depends statistically on how many L electrons are there and how many sites the B electron have access to. And within this DMFT, you can actually calculate. And it turns out that this band half bandwidth increases as the square root of x within DMFT, which you can do exactly in the large U limit. And therefore,
comes up the calculation that that lower upper band is not below or overlapping with the.
I've plotted it for small x here, and it does overlap. So that's what I'm saying is, it in fact, that bandwidth you can show that in the large U limit, you're going to infinity limit, you can calculate this exactly. That goes as the square root of x. So there's some critical xc, which is Jahn-Teller energy divided by the bandwidth squared, where this low Hubbard band will overlap with this. Pardon? Yeah? So this is basically saying that now at this critical x, there are statistically enough whole sites, empty sites, which are undistorted, that these mobile electrons gain sufficient kinetic energy, and then they begin to compete with these things. And remember, within DMFT, I don't have the Anderson localization effects, so these are mobile states. So I will, within the theory at least, I will conclude that there's an insulator metal transition exactly at this. Pardon? I will discuss that and just show you some. Within the model, yes, in principle, it will phase separate. Yeah. But okay. So let me ignore that for the moment. I will come back to that. Yeah. And so for x greater than x critical, I will have a small occupancy of the lower Hubbard band and the system is metal. So I have a simple explanation then for the ferroinsulator to ferrometal transition as a function of doping. Until you reach this x critical, everything is a polaron and it's not going to be metallic. That's the idea. Okay. And then, so these are actually the detailed calculations. You can see the U equal to infinity result and the U finite results are very similar, actually very close to each other. And this is the bandwidth reduction. So I'm going to have this trend for x critical as a function of EJT. And in fact, it's very consistent with the data. Remember, I was showing you material trends between lanthanum strontium, lanthanum calcium, neodymium thing, and then there's some rough estimates available for the effective bandwidths of those material, and basically the x critical decreases as you increase the bandwidth, or increases as you decrease the bandwidth. And the praseodymium, our explanation for why praseodymium has no metallic phases is that it's such that this x critical becomes bigger than 0.5. So until you dope to 0.5, there's no metallicity in praseodymium. The guys continue to be trapped as polaron. And once you go beyond 0.5, other physics intervenes in terms of orbital ordering, etc., which have not gone into here. And it stays insulating throughout. And one of the thing is, even when it becomes metallic within this picture, the number of the carrier density in the metallic regime is very small. I mean, a small fraction of the polarons convert themselves into mobile electrons of the order of 0.05, and this is consistent with anomalously small values inferred from carrier concentration inferred from optical conductivity and electronic Raman scattering, etc. Okay. And then what about, yeah?
What would you expect for the Fermi surface now? Would it be a very small Fermi surface?
Yeah, it will be a small Fermi surface at high temperature. Yeah, in this incoherent regime, so in fact there's some evidence I will show you actually of Hall data where there is a change in the sign of the Hall coefficient as you go from high temperature to low temperature, where I will argue at very low temperatures the coherence effect come back in, coming from this eta that I neglected, and convert into a large Fermi surface. And so the sign of the Hall coefficient is actually consistent with that.
Because there is a data of CXM and other guys that show surface.
At low temperature.
Yeah. In your model, momentum is not even a good quantum number, unless.
The model?
They're moving around in this sort of random background of available empty sites.
At high temperature, yes.
Well, tell those that those, the scale of those empty sites gets, you know, significantly bigger than the...
No, that's correct. I agree. It's
the lattice space, and can you even give it meaning to a Fermi surface?
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so how do we understand the colossal magnetoresistance within this kind of model? So the idea is that now start from the metallic phase where I have all the core spins are aligned. I have this low Hubbard band of completely spin polarized electrons. The mobile electrons are small in number, but completely spin polarized to be parallel to the core spin, right? Now you start heating the sample, what will happen? The core spins will start misaligning. Some core, you know, the core spins will become disordered random medium, and therefore there will be some probability that the mobile electrons will also have a downspin component. That's one thing that will happen. The second thing is that will happen is that the mobile electrons will now see a disordered medium of spins. Therefore, their bandwidth will shrink because they are encountering sites which are like unfavorable for them to go into. So the bandwidth will shrink. So the point is, as you heat up the sample, somewhere along the line, this bandwidth, which is already delicately poised, right, will shrink and the band will go above the Jahn-Teller energy. And at that point, I'm saying you'll have a metal to insulator transition.
And we expect there is a power, insulator to power metal transition that will increase the dope at high temperature.
Pardon?
Do you expect there is a power insulator to power metal transistor when you increase the doping at high temperature? And the bandwidth still cause the polar on band?
Yeah, I will show you a picture of that, yeah. Okay? So this is the idea. Now the thing is...
why do these have to coincide? I mean, somehow when you lose the... Well, maybe I'm missing something here, but... Are you saying that when you lose the spin polarization...
Yeah, this is in the large JH limit.
It's exactly the same point, the doping value where it comes above the Jahn-Teller?
No. In fact, the magnetic transition temperature and the place where this crosses don't coincide. They don't have to coincide.
Exactly.
Okay? So this, in fact, I will show you actually the... let me show you the...
Put the data, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, so in fact, I mean, yeah, I will show you the thing. Okay. So this is the idea. So the question is, where does the colossal magnetoresistance come from? So here, for example, I have an insulating state, right, with a very high resistance. Yeah, I'm just done. So I'm just going to argue, where is the colossal magnetoresistance going to come from? So the idea is, if you turn on a magnetic field, right, then you'll align the spins. So the disorder in the spin background will become less. So this bandwidth will expand. Now you have an exponential, you have thermally transferred carriers across this gap. So the bandwidth kind of will expand, linearly or quadratically in the magnetic field, but the number of carriers will change exponentially, and therefore there'll be a huge drop in resistivity. And so here I've shown you actually a calculation of that. So in this DMFT, actually we can calculate this everything exactly. I mean, there's no problem within DMFT. So here is this transition from para-insulator to ferrometal, very sharp. Okay, and then you turn on a magnetic field and you see this huge drop in resistivity arising from this mechanism. And actually, by just choosing two parameters, namely the effective bandwidth and the ferromagnetic transition temperature, the effective bandwidth chosen so as to fit the rho at TC, and the ferromagnetic transition coupling chosen to fit the TC, you can actually get a pretty good fit to the data. And I was showing you earlier a series of things going from para metal to ferrometal, para insulator to ferro metal, para insulator to ferro insulator. You can get that whole sequence of transitions with doping within this.
DMFT ignore vertex corrections? Or maybe I'm...
Yeah, DMFT ignoring vertex corrections. This is ignoring vertex correction within DMFT, you can calculate the thing. And here, for example, is a systematics of this magnetoresistance as a function of, this is for some reason people calculate it as delta R divided by the resistivity at a field. So that, in fact, changes by several orders of magnitude in different materials. And there's experimental data of that as a plotted as a function of TC. Yeah. delta R over R plotted as a function of TC, and those are these guys. And in the theory, what we have is this plotted as a function of 2D0, okay? And you can see that actually you can capture the trend of that over a wide range of TCs. And the TCs change because, remember, the virtual double exchange depends on D0. Okay. And then, again, you can see, depending on the bandwidth, if you have large bandwidth, you get ferrometal to para-metal transition. And if you have intermediate bandwidth, you get ferrometal to para-insulated transition. And if you have very low bandwidth, you get ferro-insulated to para-insulated transition. Okay? So that's like the experimental trends again. And there are regions here, for example, where you can go from ferrometal to ferroinsulator to para-insulator, yeah? Where technically, like, you've not reached the magnetic transition yet. This is connected to the question I was showing here. There's a region where, for example, you've gone from ferrometal to ferroinsulator, so the magnetization has not gone to zero, but that band has moved out. So technically, it's an insulator. In the sense, spectrally, it's an insulator. But nevertheless, in fact, if you look at the resistivity across here, because band gap is changing rapidly as a function of temperature, the resistivity looks metallic. So the slope is positive. So in fact, many of the materials, in fact, I was showing you an insulator to insulator transition where there's a intermediate region where the thing looked metallic, and that is the reason, because the band gap is changing very rapidly and it mimics a metallic state. Okay. So they are like that. So there are many experiments, and here are some optical data where, for example, due to Kura's group, they actually looked at the optical data and subtracted some broad background and looked at the Drude conductivity and extracted an effective number of charge carriers, so the function of temperature, okay, the Drude weight. And what we find is consistent with that, because we get the number of B electrons is kind of decreasing as you increase the temperature, because this band is going out, narrowing, and then the carriers are getting emptied out of the B band. So this is consistent with that. So we have similarly a large number of, maybe I should stop here. Okay. So there are a lot of stuff that I didn't get a chance to discuss, but in particular, in terms of interesting issues that are still open here, one is the issue you were raising about Fermi surface. Okay, so for that, one has to invoke this hybridization. Okay, so maybe just give me, can I have 5 minutes? Matthew asked a question about phase separation. I will just...
Thank you, and then I'm certainly interested in figuring out this.
Okay. Right. Okay. So, if anybody is interested, there are two issues which I'll just mention. One is the phase separation. One is phase separation issue, which is in this model that I've written down, actually, which is the Falikov-Kimball model. What you said is correct. In fact, the system will phase separate, because after all, if you put all the L electrons on one side of the sample, then the B electrons can move around on the other side of the sample and gain the full kinetic energy. Okay, but what militates against that is long-range Coulomb interaction, because that will involve a complete, like, the charge density will be 1 per site where the polarons are and some fraction on this side. So that is not permitted by the Coulomb interaction. So what we've done is actually a simulation on 20 by 20 by 20 lattice. There's a fair number of sites with this model, but putting in addition two ingredients which are not there in the model I showed you, namely the fact that you have actually dopant impurities which are randomly, like strontium with respect to calcium, which is a source of charge, randomly strewn, and then long-range Coulomb interaction between the mobile electrons and the localized electrons. And the localized electrons and each other, and this dopant impurities. Okay, if you do that, if you simulate it, you can see that the picture that you get is actually very similar to what I was showing as a scenario, namely that when you dope, you get these islands of states where, you know, where, of these empty sites where you can actually have these mobile electrons, and somewhere along the line they percolate, and then you get metallicity. Okay? And the other amazing thing is, so you can actually ask within the simulation, when do the different states start getting populated? In fact, you get now many critical constants. Okay, one is, you can ask as you dope, when is the first place that these mobile-like states, you know, which is electrons running around on empty sites, undiscarded sites, when will this first start getting populated? That is this edge here. And in fact, that edge, calculated numerically from the simulation, actually goes square root of x, is exactly very close to the DMFT picture. Which is like saying, because for this anneal disorder problem, dynamical mean field theory is like CPA, and it's well known in disordered literature that the CPA does a pretty good job of capturing density of states kind of issues. Modulo, you know, Lipschitz tails and all that. So this is doing a pretty good job of that, and in fact the simulations are very close to the DMFT prediction. But of course, it's true that the lowest states in that set of occupied mobile, quote-unquote mobile states are actually Anderson localized. So there's another doping where the mobility edge crosses the EJT, and then that's when you have the actual insulator to metal transition. Okay.
So there's a population threshold,
occupation threshold, and then the final mobility edge threshold.
I mean, within your two fluid model, why would one need, I mean, could one just treat it without DMFT at all? I mean, just take, you know, you have these clusters of empty sites and just put some, you know, free fermion in there, and, you know, to get the bandwidth and...
That's what this is doing, right?
That's
in some numerical simulation.
Yeah, so you really don't need the DMFT.
Yeah, but I, you know, but calculating the resistivity and all in this bit of a mess, no?
Okay.
In magnetic fields, spins, and at finite temperature, it's a large simulation then. Yeah, in principle doable, but for example, we have not done the finite temperature simulation of this model with long-range Coulomb interaction and then allowing for disorder and then seeing the, all the transitions. But in principle, what you said is correct. It can be done. It should be done, yeah. Sorry, so the other issue, I'll skip the core hole stuff. I was telling you that I can explain that. Okay, so here is a quick flash that you can actually, we get this core hole spectrum which goes like m squared within this model. Okay, okay. So the other issue is this thing that about this Fermi surface issue. So that involves putting this hybridization term, which I said was small and I could be thrown away, between this mobile electron and this localized electron. And then if this forms a coherent band at low enough temperature, in principle, then I could get, there is no distinction to be made between these mobile and polaronic electrons. And then I would get a large Fermi surface. Okay. So the DMFT, including this term, for example, is doable, but much more difficult in the sense it's like a Kondo problem. Actually, the impurity model that arises in this context is something called the Wigman-Finkelstein model, which is was shown to be in the same universality class as anisotropic Kondo problem long ago. So it turns out that it has this transition from to like a Fermi liquid or something, which gives me a large Fermi surface. So one of my students actually doing this DMFT, including this coherence effect. And in fact, the inclusion of this is actually important, I feel, I mean, and in fact that strange isotope effect that I talked about, actually I believe comes from this term, the role of this term in as it acts to the magnetic transition temperature. Because this eta, remember, depends exponentially on the isotope mass, because exponentially on the phonon frequency, and if you invoke that, in principle, you can account for this large change in TC arising from change in the isotopic mass. So there are lots of interesting effects connected with this which I have not discussed, including this change in Fermi surface topology, and also it will convert the Jahn-Teller effect from static to a dynamic one on some time scale. So, and there are lots of experiments actually involving NMR and various other things where you can actually see the Jahn-Teller effect being dynamic. So if we finally, when we get a handle on this, I'm hoping that we'll be able to address some of those issues connected with local. All right.
So
thank you.
So once these things become coherent, do you have an isotropic state? Is that what you expect?
Isotropic in terms of
homogeneous state.
Modulo the fact that in the real material, in the model, yes. In the model, if I don't put in disorder and long-range Coulomb interactions, there will be isotropic, I mean, homogeneous phase.
Once it becomes coherent.
Once they become coherent, absolutely. But there'll still be some small time scale kind of issue which you have to worry about, you know. The fact that, so there is a time scale thing, because that coherence is determined by the zeta. So if you take a snapshot, it'll look inhomogeneous, but on some long time scale, it'll be homogeneous. But in the real material, there are complications because you've disordered the stuff, because you've doped it with some strontium and that's sitting at some random positions, and therefore some inhomogeneity connected with that and long-range Coulomb interaction of the sort that comes up in that simulation will stay.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's...